You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dr. Paul Offit is the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And as a founding advisory board member of the Autism Science Foundation, he's been a leading voice in the ongoing debate over vaccine safety. He's the author of Autism's False Prophets and Vaccinated, and he has called his latest book, Deadly Choices, How the Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. It's published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Offit to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Dr. Andrew Wakefield wrote a report in 1998 that's been touted as proof that there's a link between certain vaccines given to children and autism, and there was an editorial in today's New York Times that lays out the case against him, citing a report last week in the British Medical Journal. But hasn't the scientific community always discredited Wakefield pretty much for a whole decade?
Yes, and for scientific reasons. I mean, what Dr. Wakefield published in The Lancet in 1998 was simply a case series of 8 children who'd received the measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR vaccine and developed autism. But he had studied nothing. The question of whether MMR causes autism can only be determined by looking at hundreds of thousands of children who either did or didn't receive that vaccine to see whether the incidence of autism was greater in the vaccinated group. That study's been done now many times in several continents by different investigators, and the answer very clearly is that MMR doesn't cause autism. So there really was never a study done by Andrew Wakefield. I mean, now we learn that he's fraudulent. Was fraudulent in some of the data in that study, but it didn't matter in the sense that the science was wrong.
Well, the Immunization Action Coalition cites 25 studies that refute a connection between the MMR vaccines and autism. But how have they proved there is no link?
Well, you know, science is based on the scientific method, which is to say that you can either reject or not reject a hypothesis. You can actually never accept the null hypothesis, which is to say you can never prove never. But certainly after a while, I think when hundreds of thousands of children are examined over a long period of time by many different investigators, I think you can say with comfort that a truth has emerged, and a truth has emerged here.
Well, I've spoken to a number of people whose children are autistic, and they say that that those studies are flawed because they suggest that all children are the same. Some children are more likely, more vulnerable to certain conditions than others, just as some people are predisposed to have diabetes, but it has to be triggered. They're saying that the MMR vaccine acts as a trigger in children who have certain genetic predispositions.
And these studies have been large enough to have been able to rule out even a very, very, very rare group of people who were susceptible to this. So I think we can say with confidence that although the anecdote of experiencing a child who got a vaccine and then appeared to develop symptoms following that vaccine, I think we can say now with confidence that that was a coincidental and not causal effect.
It's coincidental, and yet, according to there was a sevenfold increase in the instances of autism just in the 10-year period between 1988 and 1998. Boston University School of Medicine reported that. That's just a coincidence?
Well, it's certainly much has happened. I mean, in the mid-1990s, the manual that psychiatrists and psychologists use to make diagnoses like autism has changed. I mean, the definition was made more broad to include something called autistic spectrum disorder, which means that children on a much narrower end of this spectrum of speech and language and behavior were included. So that broadened the umbrella. Also, we're certainly far more aware of the disorder than we were previously. So that the question is whether there's a real increase. There may be to some extent a real increase, but I think not as dramatic as is explained by the
press. Well, sevenfold is a bit much. Many parents need no further proof of the causal relationship between the vaccines and autism other than what they witnessed in their own children. In my case, and I have to tell you that I have been a believer in some kind of connection with the vaccines. My son was given the MMR at 18 months. He ran a fever the next day. And immediately afterward, he was a different child. He stopped his speaking. He suddenly seemed dull. I had been videotaping him. And the child who I videotaped after the MMR vaccine was nothing like the child before. Now, that is anecdotal, but this is not a unique experience. So many people report something very similar.
So the question is it simply coincidence or causality? I mean, the story that I tell, because it's a true one, is my wife is in private practice pediatrics. She goes into the office on a weekend day. She's helping the nurse give vaccines. While she's drawing a vaccine up into a syringe, the four-month-old sitting on her mother's lap has a seizure. The child then goes on to develop a permanent seizure disorder, epilepsy. Now, if my wife, who hadn't given the vaccine yet, had given the vaccine 5 minutes earlier, the mother would have reasonably been convinced that it was the vaccine that did it, and no amount of statistical data in the world would have convinced her otherwise. But the fact is that when you look at as many children as have been looked at with this hypothesis, plus, everything else we know about autism spectrum disorder tells us that it's not the vaccine. I think it's very clear.
Well, many claim that the Amish who don't have their children vaccinated have lower instances of autism. Have there been studies of the rate of autism in children who haven't been vaccinated?
Well, certainly children in that, and I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I'm surrounded by Lancaster County, which has a very large Amish community. The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has a neurodevelopmental center in that county and sees many children with autism spectrum disorder, so I'm not sure how that myth was born.
Well, I've spoken to other people, parents, who say that they'd be perfectly happy to believe that the vaccines had nothing to do with it if scientists had come up with an alternative explanation. The only explanation they have is the one that they have witnessed themselves. They keep on being told that it's not true, but nobody has said, well, but here is the way it really is.
Well, I think there are actually a lot of very good studies that have pointed to the cause or causes of autism. And you have, for example, studies done showing that children with autism spectrum disorder have certain genes that are different than children who don't have autism spectrum disorder, that those genes code for proteins that help the one brain cell communicate with another. You have data by people like Eric Korshain at UCAL San Diego, where he's found structural abnormalities in the brains of children with autism spectrum disorder that appear even in utero when the child's still in the mother's womb. You have studies by Ami Klin at the Yale Child Study Center showing that an autistic child, even in the first couple weeks of life, when the mother is talking to them, will look at the mouth, whereas the non-autistic child will look at the eye. So I think this all points to events in utero. It's sad, I think, that the anti-vaccine groups have taken this story hostage, I think, much to the detriment of children with autism.
Well, there are two different kinds of ways that autism seems to show up. One is, as you say, with an infant, you know right away that there's something wrong. Then there are others who seem to be developing normally, and it's only at 18 months after coincidentally they've been given the MMR vaccine, that something happens. Is 18 months an important time in neurological development?
Well, it's certainly a time in which one can first see or certainly appreciate the signs and symptoms of autism spectrum disorder. But, you know, you really wonder whether if you go back and you look, for example, at that data that were presented by Ami Klin, and you really do the studies looking at how a child attends to the face, that there may be subtle differences that the parent didn't appreciate early on. I mean, certainly we know that vaccines aren't it.
Well, Representative Carolyn Maloney of New York's 14th District introduced a bill, H.R. 2832, the Comprehensive Comparative Study of Vaccinated and Unvaccinated Populations Act of 2007. It was never voted on. And that's another thing that bothers a lot of parents.
Well,
that there's, you know, that some study that would make it once and for all determine what's really going on has never really been made.
Well, there was a study recently in pediatrics by Michael Smith and Charles Woods where they looked at children who received all the vaccines according to the schedule, the CDC schedule, and then meaning all 14 vaccines given in the first few years of life, and compared them to children who received only a couple vaccines and had really delayed or spaced out or separated the vaccines to see whether there was any difference not only in autism but in neurodevelopmental delays. And there was no difference, as you would have imagined, given everything we know about autism spectrum disorder.
My guest is Paul A. Offit, O-F-F-I-T. His latest book, Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. It is published by Basic Books. Can you talk about herd immunity, which is a really important part of what you discuss in this book?
Right. Herd immunity is that if you haven't been vaccinated, and certainly there are many people in the United States who can't be vaccinated because they are receiving cancer chemotherapy or immunosuppressive therapy for their transplants, they depend on living among a group of vaccinated people. That's herd immunity. But there was a study done actually that may seem counterintuitive on its surface but is instructive of a measles outbreak of about 4,000 people in the Netherlands. And what they found was that you were actually better off not having received a measles vaccine vaccine and living in a highly vaccinated community than having receiving the measles vaccine and living in a relatively unvaccinated community, because no vaccine is 100% effective, and the more likely you are to be exposed, the more likely you are likely to be sick. Herd immunity is breaking down. That's why you're starting to see outbreaks of measles, mumps, whooping cough, and bacterial meningitis in the United States, because a critical number of people have stopped vaccinating their children for fears, including this false one, that vaccines cause autism.
How many vaccines are children given?
So children, young children are given vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases in the first few years of life.
An infant is given an anti-gonorrheal drop, if I remember correctly.
That's just an antibiotic. That's not a vaccine. Right.
Yeah, but why something anti-gonorrheal for an infant who has a very limited immune system at that point? The child isn't likely to get gonorrhea until puberty.
Well, the fear is obviously that the child would be passing through a birth canal where Neisseria gonorrhea existed, and should that happen, they would be—
Well, but that would be easily determined whether the parent had gonorrhea or syphilis without giving it to every child who's born.
Right. It's actually not just gonorrhea. It's also chlamydia, which is a much more common disease, and parents often, or the mother often, isn't tested for that. So that's the reason. But I think you underestimate the newborn's immune system. I think we come out of the womb when we're largely ready to come out. And probably the best example of that is the hepatitis B vaccine. If you look at babies who are born to mothers who are infected with hepatitis B virus, and those babies then pass through a birth canal that contains blood, that contains billions of hepatitis B virus particles, if you give that child a single shot of just 20 micrograms, which is a millionth of a gram of hepatitis B vaccine, 85% of those children would be protected against hepatitis B because they can make a vigorous immune response. I think we obviously have to. We have this tremendous onslaught of bacteria when we're born. We would have to be able to respond if our species is to survive.
So tests have been done to determine whether a child's immune system is robust enough to withstand all of these different vaccinations?
Sure. A vaccine could never be licensed unless you clearly show that the vaccine is not only safe and effective, but that when you add a vaccine to the existing schedule, that vaccine doesn't interfere with the safety or immune profile of the existing vaccines, and that they don't interfere with the safety or immune profile of that vaccine. That the vaccine would never be licensed otherwise.
What about in cases of children with predispositions to mitochondria disorders?
Yeah, again, there's no – if you're talking regarding autism, there remains no evidence that mitochondrial disorders clearly predispose one to developing autism following receipt of the vaccine.
Now, there are countries where the MMR vaccines are administered separately, and it's argued in this country that we bundle them up simply to make things easier for drug manufacturers and pediatricians.
Well, we make things easier for children. I mean, it's much, much less painful to get two shots of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine than to get six separate shots as a vaccine.
And why give everybody a rubella shot? I had German measles when I was a kid. It was a rather benign illness. It kept me out of school, I think, for 2 days. And now I will never get it again.
Right, and as you state correctly, rubella is a mild disease of childhood.
So why even bother give it? Because it's been linked to autism, hasn't it?
Well, it's obviously the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is not linked to autism, but rubella, at least prior to the rubella vaccine's entry into the introduction in the United States in 1969, rubella would, in its worst years, when it infects the mother during the first trimester of pregnancy, there's an 85% chance that child will be born with severe birth defects, and we would see 20,000 cases of birth defects a year. Every year from this virus. So having the vaccine has been a godsend.
So why not just give it to girls?
Because
boys do not become pregnant.
Boys don't become pregnant. I support that. The problem is,
I know it's anecdotal, but so far that's been my experience.
That's an anecdote I'll agree with. I think that the problem, though, is that girls catch rubella virus from boys, and therefore if you really want to eliminate rubella from the population, it's best to immunize both boys and girls.
My guest is Paul A. Offit, who is chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is also Maurice R. Hillman Professor of Vaccinology and a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. His latest book, Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All, is published by Basic Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Paul A. Offit, who has written a book called Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. It's published by Basic Books. This is the third book you've written on this subject. Are you going to keep on writing them until you convince everybody?
No, I think this wraps me up. Hopefully this will do it.
Now, what happened in Britain? There was a drop in vaccinations after Wakefield issued his published studies in The Lancet. Has there been a major increase in measles, or has there been any change in the amount of autism reported?
Well, certainly what happened was tragic. After that article was published in 1998, thousands of parents chose not to vaccinate their children with measles, mumps, rubella vaccine because they were scared that they were going to cause autism. And what happened then was hundreds of children were hospitalized with measles. Four children died of measles. I mean, died of a disease that was perfectly and safely preventable by vaccines. And fear travels. And so it crossed the ocean. And we came to believe, too, at least some parents, that MMR might cause autism. As a result, parents of at least 125,000 children chose not to vaccinate them with MMR, and we had an epidemic in 2008 of measles that was bigger than anything we'd seen in more than a decade because of this false fear. You know, I mean, parents are trying to do the best they can for their children. Certainly one understands that, but I think we scared parents unnecessarily here and did harm.
Well, there have been any number of other vaccines that have turned out to be causing harm. There was the Sabin polio vaccine, which actually infected people with polio. You have a vaccine that you created, Rotatec, administered to children within the first 36 weeks of life, and that was a vaccine that replaced RotaShield, the rhesus rotavirus vaccine, which had to be discontinued.
Right. And
it was being given to children, wasn't it?
That's right. And so vaccines, like any medical product that has a positive effect, can have a negative effect. Vaccines are no different. And you're right. Not the oral polio vaccine created by Albert Sabin was a rare cause of polio in this country. And even though we'd eliminated wild type or natural polio, every year 6 to 8 children got polio from the oral polio vaccine. I was actually head of the CDC working group of polio in 1998 that moved us away from that vaccine to the inactivated vaccine, for the Salk vaccine, for just that reason. The RotaShield vaccine, too, which preceded our Rotatec vaccine by about 7 years, was a very, very rare cause of intestinal blockage called intussusception. For that reason, it was taken off the market. But again, that was a real side effect that was picked up quickly, identified, and then taken off. This business about vaccines as a cause of autism is not real. It's a false concern.
Another concern parents had was thimerosal. You want to talk about it?
Sure. So the hypothesis for the autism vaccine link continues to morph. First, it was MMR. Then it became thimerosal, which is an ethyl mercury-containing preservative that was in a number of vaccines that were given to young children. And so the question became, could this ethyl mercury-containing preservative be what was causing autism, or at least mercury toxicity? And the answer—
Because often autism looks a lot like mercury poisoning.
Actually, there's this wonderful study by Margaret Bauman and Karen Nelson, neurologists at NIH, and that looked at this. And interestingly, the signs and symptoms of mercury, there are a number of them that are clearly distinct from autism. So I think it was never really made sense to begin with. And now we know from what are roughly 7 studies that not only did children who received these mercury-containing vaccines not develop autism, they also didn't even develop subtle signs of mercury poisoning.
The thimerosal was used as a way of cleaning, keeping everything sanitized. But it had already been banned from contact lens cleansers and other things for adults. And some of the parents felt, well, gee, we're giving mercury to our infants, and the same thing that we're preventing adults from having to go through.
Well, yes, certainly mercury at high doses is a neurotoxin. Mercury is never going to sound good. It's not like there's the National Center for the Appreciation of Heavy Metals that's going to stand up in defense of mercury. I agreed with that. But the question always is one of dose. I mean, mercury is in the Earth's crust. We're all exposed to mercury. The water that I'm drinking right now contains low levels of mercury, but it's not going to hurt me because the dose makes the poison, and the dose is well less than that's poisonous.
And it's also been pointed out that there's a difference between ethyl mercury, which has been used in the vaccines, and methyl mercury, other than the fact that one has an M at the beginning of it?
Right. Ethyl mercury is a larger molecule. It's excreted. It's eliminated from the body much more quickly than is methyl mercury, which is what we think of as mercury in the environment because that's environmental mercury. But the M makes a difference, as you say. I mean, there's a difference between ethyl alcohol, which is the alcohol that we have in wine or beer, and methyl alcohol, which is wood alcohol that if you drink enough of it, you'd go blind. So the M makes a difference.
Parents of autistic children say that there are high levels of heavy metals in their children when they're tested for that. Could that just be a problem that that genetically they are predisposed to not be able to handle heavy metals the way the rest of us are?
I don't think it's a problem at all, quite frankly. I mean, if you look at the data that were generated in terms of how those tests were done, often those children were given medicine, so-called chelating agents, which are metal binding agents, and then within a few hours tested to see whether they're excreting metals. Of course they're excreting metals. All of us would be excreting metals. The question to do that the right way, you really need to look at a 24-hour excretion. That it's not often not done that way. And so I think a lot of that information is frankly just bogus.
How have outspoken vaccine opponents like J.B. Hanley and Jenny McCarthy changed the way the anti-vaccination movement has participated in the conversation?
I think they've made it a little meaner, a little more personal and cruder. I think the woman who was probably most identified with the anti-vaccine movement when it was born, I would argue in this country, the modern anti-vaccine movement in the early 1980s, is a woman named Barbara Lowe Fisher, who although I would disagree with her point of view because I think she claims vaccines cause things that they don't cause, but she was generally trying to get her information out there, but she was never really personally attacking people. I think Jenny McCarthy, J.B. Hanley, to a lesser extent Jim Carrey, Bill Maher, I mean, they when they get into it, it's just been a little cruder, a little meaner, a little more. What you hear is these kind of ad hominem attacks, which I think are a very low form of debate and logically worthless.
All of them parents of children or connected to people who have children who are autistic?
Yeah, that seems to be the current theme. Certainly Jenny McCarthy has a child that presumably is autistic. Jim Carrey was her boyfriend. I don't think Bill Maher has that connection, but he got into it too.
But why do you think that they're not convinced by your arguments?
Yeah, I think they for whatever reason, not everyone seems to be convinced by good science. I think some people hold on to these ideas as one would hold on to a religious belief, and they just simply are not going to be convinced.
Well, we were reassured that Vioxx was good. We've been reassured that any number of other drugs were good, and turns out that they can cause harm in some people, not everybody, which is to some degree the argument that the autism people are making.
I think that it's perfectly reasonable for a parent to ask the question, could this vaccine, for example, have caused this side effect, in this case autism? It's a perfectly reasonable question to ask, but it is answerable. I mean, I think that when you do study after study after study, spending millions and frankly tens of millions of dollars to answer that question, I think that should be believed. People have responded to parents' concerns. I mean, when people like Jenny McCarthy said that you should listen to what the parents say, people have listened and done those studies. The problem isn't that. The problem is that for whatever reason, those studies haven't been convincing to people like Jenny McCarthy.
My guest is Paul A. Offit, whose latest book is Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. It is published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're the Maurice Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. What were the potential dangers of Maurice Hilleman's hepatitis B vaccine in the late 1970s? There weren't any?
Well, Maurice Hilleman was the first – actually, when Maurice Hilleman first made an experimental hepatitis B vaccine, he actually made it using the blood of homosexual men here in New York City. And at the time in the late 1970s, there was a virus that was also likely to be in that blood that people didn't know about, that we know about now, called human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, the cause of AIDS. He treated that preparation, the preparations of blood, with three chemicals, each of which as we now know, completely inactivated the HIV virus. So there really was no problem. And obviously, by the time that vaccine was marketed, the so-called plasma-derived vaccine in 1981, when the virus had been identified, this was not a problem. But yeah, that was an interesting time.
John Hopkins now has a class which prepares students to communicate the safety of vaccines in relation to autism. Are other medical schools doing that as well?
Not to my knowledge. Hopkins, this is probably Neil Halsey, who's head of something they're called the Institute for Vaccine Safety, which, you know, and he's been great at trying to get out in front of this. So that's probably what that's about. Not to my knowledge, no.
The LA Times reports that almost 11% of all babies born in the United States are premature, but they're given the vaccines at the same schedule. Why don't you wait?
Well, often there are data in premature infants, to prematurity defined as children born before 37 weeks gestation. There often are data to answer that question. Again, you know, it's a choice not to get a vaccine is not a risk-free choice. It's a choice to in this case, delay vaccination and increase the period of time during which you're susceptible to those diseases. So it's, you know, I think vaccines offer parents something that's critical, which is putting the child in the safest position possible.
In October 2010, the United States Supreme Court heard a case on the potential risks of White's diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine, the DTP vaccine. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes. It's Brucewitz v. Wyeth.
What happened?
Well, the claim from – I think the child's name is Hannah Brucewitz – was that she had – when she had received the DPT vaccine, the P stands for pertussis or whooping cough, that the pertussis component had caused her to have mental retardation, permanent seizure disorder. We now know from many studies that the pertussis vaccine didn't cause permanent damage, so that's permanent brain damage. So that I think that's that lawsuit at least is not based on good science.
But the courts decided in favor of the parents, didn't they?
I don't think the courts haven't made a decision yet.
What about the seizures?
Well, again, it's interesting you bring that up. I mean, I would argue that the birth of the modern American anti-vaccine movement occurred on a single day. It was April 19th, 1982, with a show by Lee Thompson called DPT Vaccine Roulette that claimed, showed a series of children who had mental retardation, seizure disorder, claimed to be caused by the whooping cough vaccine. I mean, when eventually epidemiological studies showed that it wasn't that brain damage wasn't a consequence of pertussis vaccine. But more interestingly, there was a study done in The Lancet in 2006, Lancet Neurology, that went back and looked at a lot of those children and found that they had something called a neuronal sodium channel transport defect, which is just a fancy way of saying that they had one brain cell had trouble communicating with another. And it's a genetic mutation, and it was defined. And that got no publicity, which is too bad because it finally answered the question everyone had.
But you have problems with The Lancet because The Lancet also published Wakefield studies. So we believe what we want to believe in all of this, don't we?
Well, I think, again, it's, you know, the truth is that sometimes scientific journals get it wrong. Sometimes, you know, there are medical products that are made that are harmful, but it doesn't mean that therefore all medical journals get it wrong or therefore all medical products that are made are harmful. I don't think that's the lesson.
So where do we go from here? If we say that it isn't the vaccines, we say there's some kind of genetic predisposition in some children. What do we do other than certain educational approaches like ABA or floor play and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an autism expert, but what I would say is just having looked at this fairly closely that it is encouraging that some of these genes that are associated with autism are being defined, that the proteins those genes make are being defined, and that there may be, I think, then early medical interventions that could alter the outcome of autism. So I think there's every reason to be hopeful.
Each year, the CDC compiles a list of reported reactions to vaccines, and in 2009, in the United States, there were 35,000 such incidents, nearly 50 deaths, in fact. So what are the causes of those adverse reactions?
Right. So there was in 1986 established something called the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, whereby anybody, parent, doctor, nurse, anybody, personal injury lawyer, can report a side effect that may have been associated with the vaccine. But again, these are associations in time, not necessarily causal associations. And when – so for example, with the human papillomavirus vaccine, the HPV vaccine, the vaccine to prevent cervical cancer, there were a lot of girls who claimed that following that vaccine, they developed chronic fatigue syndrome or blood clots and consequent strokes and heart attacks. But when the CDC did the right kinds of studies, which is to say to look at people who did or didn't receive that vaccine to see whether the incidence of those side effects was greater in the vaccinated group. It wasn't. So that's the problem with that reporting system. I think it can be very misleading.
Getting back to an earlier answer, I recently was involved in a conference about spinal cord injuries. And the complaint of most of the people who had the spinal cord injuries was that the scientists working at the benches had no idea what their lives were like. There was a total disconnect. And I got to get the feeling the same thing happens with people like you. Do you speak to the parents of children who are autistic?
Of course. I mean, I'm one of the founding board members of the Autism Science Foundation, so I deal with these parents. Of course I do. I mean, that's in part what's so compelling about this for me. I think that they have been misled by this vaccine story, and I think it's only ultimately hurt their children because it's diverted a lot of money and attention away from what I think are the real cause or causes of autism. And I don't – the whole sort of like Lorenzo's oil thing, you know, that they're that only if parents sort of get involved and push scientists, then only do scientists care. I mean, I'm a scientist who's a co-inventor of a vaccine. Scientists care deeply about this. That's why they do what they do.
Paul A. Offit's latest book, his third on the relationship between vaccines and autism, is called Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. It's published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.